Well, thank you very much for inviting me out here all the way across the Harbour Bridge from Macquarie. I should explain that I'm an ancient historian. That is to say, I'm a senior lecturer in ancient history at the Department of Ancient History at Macquarie University, and I've been there for now more than 20 years, teaching a range of things, both early Christian history and Greco-Roman history in the centuries around about. I'm a committed Christian, but I am also a committed professional historian. And so the questions I'm going to be dealing with today are predominantly historical questions, and I hope to be using arguments that do not depend on any particular Christian viewpoint. These are arguments that a historian, whether or not they were a Christian, could evaluate, could come to some kind of decision about. That's my aim today, and we'll see how we go with the subject. By the way, I was particularly delighted with the comment about celebrating Easter due to chocolate. It's always seemed to me that this is much underestimated. As I see it, one of the most important reasons for the ecology movement in our modern world is we have to realise that the Earth is the only place in the known universe that has chocolate. And this makes it worth saving. What I hope is that we'll have the courage of our confections. You've been warned. However, I want to start by making one simple claim about the resurrection of Jesus, and then breaking down my argument into four essential parts. The great central claim I want to make is this. When the early Christians claimed that Jesus had risen from the dead, there were quite a few things they did not mean. When they said Jesus lives, they did not mean, for example, what people say when they say, with increasing rarity nowadays, Elvis lives. Which, as far as I can tell, probably means, well, actually, he doesn't, he's dead, but I really like his music. And you still see the T-shirts occasionally saying, Shay lives, which once again means, well, actually, he doesn't, but his ideas are crucially important, and we ought to take them seriously. These are all metaphors. But when the early Christians said, Jesus lives, we have to understand they did not mean, he's terribly important for me and it would be nice to think he was still around. The early Christians actually meant, with extraordinary literalism, that Jesus, who had been executed by the Romans in either 30 or 33 AD, we're not entirely sure which, but mid-April to early May of either 30 or 33 AD, is with considerable historical certainty when Jesus was executed by the Romans. What they were claiming was this same Jesus had come back to life in an otherwise utterly inexplicable way. It was, in other words, a staggering miracle that they were claiming, and they knew it. Now, in the Northern Hemisphere, where Christianity came to dominate over the centuries, basically because they hadn't discovered very much of the Southern Hemisphere yet, all of this got a little bit mixed up with all the things that Easter is culturally about. Easter in the Northern Hemisphere is all about the coming of spring. It's all about new life, hence eggs. Hence, by one step of logic, chocolate eggs. But it's all about the return of life. And there's a sense in which Easter makes perfectly good cultural sense in the Northern Hemisphere as a kind of mythological statement. The darkness, the cold, the forces against life are all coming to the end of their tenure. Now we have spring, now we have new growth. That's what resurrection means. That all seemed to make sense to a lot of people. But you need to understand that that was not what the early Christians were claiming. The early Christians were claiming that in a particular year, in a particular place, at a particular time, one man, extraordinarily, who had been dead, was dead no longer. That was the claim, and the question is, how credible is it? To answer this, I'm going to ask four basic questions and go through them one at a time. The first basic question is, what is the earliest historical evidence for this belief? It may surprise you that the earliest evidence is not the Gospels. The second question is, how reliably has the evidence for this belief been reported over the years between when it was first claimed to when it was written down in the form we have it in the Gospels? How reliably has the evidence been passed on? Thirdly, we'll be asking where such a belief might have originated in that first century AD Greco-Roman world. And finally, we're going to be asking how the early Christians argued for this belief in terms of religious and philosophical propaganda in the first century. What kinds of arguments did they use? We'll be dealing with each of these one by one. And the one we'll actually be starting with, number one, is this. What is the earliest evidence for this belief? Now, as I said, it may be a surprise, but the Gospels in the New Testament are not the earliest evidence for the belief in the resurrection of Jesus. The Gospels were probably written starting in the late 60s AD through the early 70s, perhaps into the 80s and 90s AD, but starting late 60s or early 70s. We're not precisely sure, but that's the most likely time bracket. Whereas the earliest known Christian documents are not the Gospels, but the letters of St. Paul, which were written probably starting in either 49 or 50 AD. In other words, only about 20 years after the death of Jesus. And particularly, the earliest evidence we have that really lays out in detail a historical argument for for Jesus' resurrection is 1 Corinthians chapter 15, the passage that was read to you just a couple of minutes ago. And historians can tell you that 1 Corinthians, the first letter that Paul wrote, the first letter that survives that Paul wrote to the church in Corinth after he'd founded it, this letter was written somewhere between 53 and 55 AD. Now, let me explain what I just said and then tell you how we know the date. I just stopped myself saying the first letter that Paul wrote. The reason that we know it isn't the first letter that Paul wrote is that one of the things Paul says in this letter is, in my previous letter, I mentioned to you X. But the previous letter, as far as we know, doesn't survive. So we have to call it 0 Corinthians. Or else we have to renumber the current Corinthian letters. There are two letters to the church in Corinth in the New Testament. There is at least that other one, 0 Corinthians, or minus 1 Corinthians, or whatever you want to call it. And then in 2 Corinthians, he also talks about another letter, which he says he wrote with many tears. So now we have 1, 2, 3, and 4 Corinthians. The important point, however, is that we can date Paul's visit to Corinth to within a year of 51 AD. 50 to 52, but bracketing 51 AD is absolutely clear-cut because in the book of Acts we're told that the Roman governor in Achaia, that is, the Roman province of which Corinth was the capital, was one Annius Gallio. Now, we know quite a lot about this man. He was a relative of the famous Roman playwright and philosopher Seneca, and he actually set up a monument inscribed on stone at Delphi, a famous religious shrine in northern central Greece, in the year that he was governor in Achaia. So Acts' report allows us to fit together with the inscription on stone that Annius Gallio himself set up, and we know that Annius Gallio was Roman governor in Corinth in 51. And Paul was there at the same time. But what we don't know is whether Paul's 18 months in Corinth was at the beginning of Annius Gallio's period or late in Annius Gallio's period. So the two sets of dates, if you like, concertina a little bit. Then Paul travelled. Then he wrote back to the Corinthians. And that can be dated, with those concertina effects built in, to about 53 to 55 AD. Now notice, depending on when you date the death of Jesus, because the death of Jesus might be in 30 AD, or it might be in 33 AD, this is maybe only 20 years since Jesus' death. It may be 22, 23 years, but that's about the maximum. The claim that Paul makes is quite significant, and if you have the passage, it'd be worth opening it at this point and see what he says. Brothers and sisters, I want to remind you of the gospel I preached to you, which you received and on which you've taken your stand. By this gospel you're saved, and you hold firmly to the word I preached to you. Otherwise, you've believed in vain. What I received, I passed on to you as of first importance. So, writing between 53 and 55, Paul says, I passed this message on to you. The question is, when did he do that? Answer, 2 to 3 years previously, when he actually founded the church. In other words, somewhere around 51 AD is when he passed it on to them. But, he says, he had passed on to them what he himself had received, and that this was of the first importance. What was it? That Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and then a list of the various people who were witnesses to this event. Now the crucial point here is that we are starting at 53 or 55 and pushing back. 53 or 55 is when Paul wrote the letter saying these things. About 51 is when he passed it on to the Corinthians. But when was it passed on to him as a central claim of the first importance? What is the earliest evidence for the belief in Jesus having risen from the dead? The list was passed on to Paul saying he appeared to Cephas, that's the Hebrew or Aramaic version of Peter's name. He appeared then to Peter, to the 12, and to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. He appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, says Paul, also to me. Where does that list, with the exception of Paul adding himself to the bottom of it, originate? The answer is almost certainly that Paul would have received this list of who saw what when he first travelled to Jerusalem after his conversion. Now, we can't date his conversion with any certainty, but we do know that he himself says in his letter to the Galatian churches, another early letter, that his first visit to Jerusalem wasn't until 3 years after his conversion, and he didn't go back again to Jerusalem for another 14 years. These aren't second-hand reports that a later historian has given. These are Paul's own letters telling his own life story. They are first-hand evidence, and as such they are excellent evidence. And what they seem to me to suggest is that Paul received this list of who saw Jesus risen from the dead during his first visit to Jerusalem, which Galatians tells us he spent 2 weeks with Peter and also met James, that is to say, Jesus' own brother. But, he says, I didn't meet any of the other apostles, just Peter and James, and really I only just met James, it was Peter I spent time with. Now, it seems to me overwhelmingly likely that that is when Jesus' list of appearances was passed on to Paul. Now, when can we date that? And the answer is, it must, for Paul's chronology of his career to work, be dated before 40 AD. In other words, to put it very simply, the earliest evidence we have for the belief that Jesus had risen from the dead comes from before 40 AD. That is to say, within 10 years or less of the events themselves. That's impressive. The earliest evidence we have does not come from the 70s AD. It comes from the 40s AD. Or perhaps the late 30s AD. So, That's the answer to our first question, what is the earliest evidence for this belief? Answer, it's the list passed on to Paul on his first visit to Jerusalem by or before 40 AD. We come now to the second part of the question, how reliably has the evidence for these stories been passed on? Because, you see, there is a period of approximately 30 years or so, from 30-ish to the 60s and 70s AD, 30 or 40 years, during which the stories about Jesus and his resurrection, along with all the rest of the stories about Jesus, were passed on primarily by word of mouth. Now, this was a culture in which passing on information by word of mouth was much more normal than it is in our culture. We are all terribly writing dependent. Actually, it's worse than that. We're all terribly computer dependent. I can't even write a talk anymore without a word processor that can handle outlining, and for heaven's sake, I'm reading you the notes off my iPad, but don't worry, it's the old model. And I got it at Christmas. This was a culture that was far more used to relying on oral memory. I can't even go shopping without a written list, but that's because I'm not in the habit. Ancient people, including ancient people who were genuinely literate, depended far more than we do on their own memories, on verbal memory. And that gives us at least some hope that they've, over this 30 to 40 year period between the events and the writing down of the Gospels, done a careful job of passing on the stories. I want to show you some of the evidence that suggests strongly that they have done a careful job. The first piece of evidence is the extraordinary gaps in the story in the Gospels. There is so much that we would like to know about the resurrection of Jesus, which we are not told. Specifically, there are no eyewitnesses to the actual event. Nobody saw it happen. Now, this is frustrating. Clearly, what you need is eyewitnesses to the event. What you want is a camera ringside at the resurrection. That would be ideal. And it is fascinating to note that somebody, an early Christian who we don't know very much about, wrote a document which calls itself the Gospel of Peter. And they wrote it somewhere around about 95 AD. We're not sure precisely when. Only one copy of part of this document has ever been found. But it tells you the story of Jesus' death and resurrection starting during his trial. The first words have to do with Pilate. Now, this is a later document which is clearly derivative from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Somebody has taken bits of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and embroidered them together to tell the story with a bit more drama, a bit more pizzazz, a bit more excitement. And what they do is they actually let you see what happened. They let you see because the stone rolls away from the front of the tomb all by itself. And two figures come down out of the heavens and go into the cave. And when they come out of the cave, there aren't two of them, there are three. And behind them comes the cross, I presume walking on its little feet. And they say, have you preached to those who sleep? And the cross answers, yes, which is really quite interesting and dramatic. But the point about this extraordinary narrative is, A, it's clearly dependent on the Gospels we have, B, it is clearly embroidering above and beyond the Gospels we have. And it tells you what actually happened middle of the night. And then it tells you why nobody knew what happened. Because the guards go back to Pontius Pilate and say, this is what we've seen. Now make sure that nobody ever finds out. And he swears them all to silence. Which is, of course, how the author of the Gospel of Peter knows. Yes, this is just a little bit of a worry, isn't it? He tells you the story and then tells you how he couldn't have known it. Now, what's striking about the Gospels is they do not tell you things that no one could have known. The Gospels tell you who saw what. they do not tell you, and no one ever saw this. Which is, of course, kind of encouraging. The Gospels, in other words, seem to report only what particular individuals could have actually seen. Not only that, but the Gospels avoid theological hindsight. We know quite a lot about what early Christians believed about resurrection, because they believed that their own resurrection after their deaths to come would be in some sense logically related to the resurrection of Jesus. They talked about dying and rising with Christ, for example. And they talked about Jesus' death being the first fruits of the great resurrection that is to come. This was standard theological language for them, which requires a bit of explanation. We're no longer primarily an agricultural society, so the metaphor first fruits doesn't instantly ring bells for us. But in most ancient societies, and certainly in ancient Israel, there was a standard festival at the very beginning of the harvest where you ceremonially cut the first sheaf of grain or harvested the first fruits, and you presented them to God as a thank you offering that the harvest had actually begun. Now that metaphor is the one Paul uses, and the one other Christians use as well. They say that Jesus' resurrection is the first fruits of the resurrection from the dead. It's the beginning. It's the, if you like, down payment, might be our metaphor. Now, the point in telling you all this is that the early Christians had lots of beliefs about resurrection. They believed when the great day of the resurrection of all the dead came, for example, the archangel of God would blow his trumpet and everybody, including the dead, would hear it. It's a wake-up call on a grand scale. That there would be various signs in the heavens, and all of this and all of the language about first fruits is what they took for granted about resurrection. But the important point to note about this is how little of it there is in the Gospels. When Jesus is raised from the dead, there isn't the trumpet of the archangel of God. When Jesus is raised from the dead, it's not described as being the first fruits. In other words, the early Christians are simply reporting what they take to be events, and they're not embroidering into the story they're telling the language they are used to for describing resurrection. They seem to be reporting in quite a cautious way, without just using familiar language of images of resurrection, which we know from other Christian documents they had and believed in. Now, the most striking example of this is language that almost everyone takes for granted. When did Jesus rise from the dead? On the third day. Those who go to church have heard this every time the Apostles' Creed is read. Those who do not go to church may have heard it simply by hearing St. Paul's letter read today. On the third day he rose again is standard language. And in the Gospels, Jesus predicts that he will rise again on the third day. This on the third day language is really locked in the early Christian memory of Jesus' resurrection. Not only that, but there were some Jewish beliefs that the great resurrection itself would have a third day element to it. For example, Hosea chapter 6 verse 2 has the following general purpose comment when it's talking about when will God finally save his people. Hosea says, after 2 days he will revive us, on the third day he will raise us up so that we may live before him. So this on the third day language was language that the early Christians used with all kinds of little resonances of their Hebrew Bibles ringing in their ears. Of course it was on the third day. It had almost been prophesied. It made sense that way. And as I said, despite the fact that the Gospels record that Jesus predicted he would rise on the third day, do you know what every single one of the Gospels says about when Jesus was raised from the dead? They don't say on the third day. They all say on the day after the Sabbath. Simple factual report of time without the standard theological language that they all had in their heads, that we know they all had in their heads, because they used it in other places. What is remarkable here is that they've passed on the story without colouring it with standard theological language. They've passed on what you'd have to describe as pretty plain reports. It happened on the day after the Sabbath. That's all. What's striking is the lack of precision in the reports. Now, this is a perverse little bit of argument. Work with me here for a second. If you take the accounts in the different Gospels and try to cut and paste them together to make a precise order of events of who saw what when, it's actually extremely difficult to do. I don't think it's impossible. At least two scholars that I know of, Gordon Wenham and George Eldon Ladd, have independently argued that you can, in fact, get a complete list of events in a credible historical order. But it's not easy. And many people reading the accounts say, look, you just can't. The events won't jigsaw together neatly at all, therefore they're not terribly reliable. Now, I have to say to you that that is not the way historians think. The way historians think is, if the accounts rough and ready fit together but not neatly, that's actually pretty good. Because if the accounts fit together really neatly, that raises the serious suspicion that they've been written so as to fit together really neatly. In other words, that they are not independent reports, that they've been rigged. The accounts in the Gospels do not look as if they've been rigged. They look like semi-independent reports of highly confusing events. And it is from that point of view that I think the evidence suggests that the stories about Jesus' resurrection have been reported pretty cautiously. The gaps that are in the story have been left in the story. There hasn't been much use of theological hindsight, and the reports aren't neatly worked together into a perfect seamless narrative. They look like honest reporting of confusing events, and I find that really quite encouraging. Most encouraging, however, is the earliest witnesses to the resurrection of Jesus, because all the Gospels make it clear that the first eyewitnesses to Jesus' resurrection were women, and particularly Mary Magdalene. Now, the reason I find this encouraging is precisely because ancient people would not. Girls, you're going to hate this bit. Sorry. But in ancient Roman courts and in ancient Jewish courts, women's testimony didn't count because women were believed not to be sufficiently rational. So women's evidence, I'm afraid, simply didn't measure up. Not only that, but Mary Magdalene isn't just a woman. She's a woman, according to the Gospels, out of whom Jesus had cast seven devils. So she's not just a woman. She's a woman with a long history of mental illness. To be awfully blunt, if I were inventing a story about a resurrection, I would not choose as my first eyewitness a woman at all. And I certainly wouldn't choose one with a history of mental illness, because she's not a terribly credible witness. And as far as I can tell, the only reason the early Christians tell us that she was the first witness is that she was. And there was no getting around it. It's not what they would have used as their best argument, but it's simply what had happened. And then there are lots of other witnesses as well, perhaps more credible, certainly more male. The important point in all of this, though, is it seems to me that the Gospel accounts have not been written up for maximum persuasion. They've been written up cautiously with regard to what appear to be facts. Now, the third question is, where might such a belief have originated in that first century world? Now, I might explain what it is I'm actually arguing here. I am not asking the question, where might the belief have originated that Jesus had risen from the dead? You can find endless books on that subject. It's been covered by lots and lots of people. What I'm asking is a broader and more general question. I'm asking the question, where might the belief that anyone could have risen from the dead have originated? Where might the idea of the principle of someone rising from the dead have originated in that world? The first possibility is that it might have arisen in the Greek, or perhaps we should say, the Greco-Roman world. In other words, it might not be a really early Christian idea going back to the Jewish world. It might be an idea that had developed among Greek disciples of Jesus, if the idea of rising from the dead was more of a Greek idea. Excuse me. Is it, for example, a case of what has been called in scholarship the myth of dying and rising gods, which scholars have said you can tell there existed in the ancient world, myths of dying and rising gods? Now, there are two reasons why this isn't a terribly satisfactory explanation. The first reason is that the great majority of ancient Greco-Roman people did not believe in life after death at all. You can tell, because tens of thousands of ancient letters have been preserved as papyrus in the dry hot sands of Egypt. And among them there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of letters of condolence. Letters saying, I'm so sorry to hear that so and so has died. And I've looked at these, lots of them, probably not all of them by a long way, but lots of them. And do you know, I have not yet found a single one that says, your beloved is in a better place and much happier now. What they always say, always the ones I've read, is, what can you do? This is the common fate of all humanity. That's it. Comfort yourselves. To be awfully blunt, I don't find that terribly comforting at all. But what you get is a picture of people who, by and large, did not believe in life after death, or if they did, had very little clear idea about life after death. Not only that, but where they did believe in life after death, it wasn't physical. Right from the earliest Greek thinkers, thinkers like Plato, for example, in the 4th century BC, there is a phrase that became a little catchphrase for the idea of life after death being spiritual. And the phrase was simply two words in Greek, a kind of theological pun, soma sema. The body, soma, is a tomb, sema. The body is a tomb. And what they meant by that is, your soul is trapped in your body until you die. Paradoxically, your body is a tomb for your soul. But when you die, your soul is free, liberated, at last. So those Greeks, particularly those intellectual Greeks, who did believe in some kind of life after death, did not believe in physical life after death. They believed in a life after death where your soul was finally liberated from your body. To put it bluntly, the idea of coming back with a new body, being physically raised from the dead, would have seemed to them very much like a retrograde step. Getting a new body, isn't the whole point that you get out of those things? Isn't the whole point that your spirit is now free of physical existence? Having a new body sounds like a backward step. It seems, therefore, on both grounds, both on the rarity of real belief in life after death in the Greek world, and in terms of the kind of life after death that people in the Greek world, when they did believe in it at all, believed in, the idea of the physical resurrection of Jesus would simply not have been terribly attractive. But what about these dying and rising gods? If ancient people really did believe in dying and rising gods, isn't that where the idea of Jesus' resurrection came from? Well, the short answer is, I really don't think so, for two reasons. Number one, dying and rising gods have actually been highly overrated. There aren't many of them in the ancient world. There are only a few. The most prominent of them is the ancient Egyptian god Osiris, who dies every winter. As the crops die down and as the grass dies down, he dies every winter, and then rises again every spring with the coming of new growth. It's that old agricultural cycle of the seasons myth concept that we were talking about earlier. If you were to ask a genuine believer in the god Osiris, what year was it that Osiris rose from the dead? They'd look at you funny, because it's the wrong question. It's exactly the wrong sort of question, in the same way that it's the wrong question if you ask an Aboriginal Australian, what year was it that the rainbow serpent carved out the banks of the Todd River? It's a silly question. It happened in the dream time. And the dream time doesn't have chronology. It's the dream time. In the same way, dying and rising gods died and rose again in the ancient Greek equivalent of the dream time. By contrast, the early Christians claimed that it happened under Pontius Pilate, Roman prefectorial governor, 26 to 36 AD, Judea, at a time, at a place. In other words, the belief that Jesus had risen from the dead was of a fundamentally different kind to the belief that Osiris died and rose again. Osiris dying and rising again is a way of saying new life comes again every spring. The death and resurrection of Jesus were not argued that way. It's a different kind of claim. It's the difference, to put it bluntly, between myth and history. Osiris rises from the dead in myth. The early Christians claim that Jesus rises from the dead in history. So, there are also, in the ancient Greek world, claims that various people's souls had ascended to heaven. Is this where the idea came from? Well, the short answer to this is no, because the early Christians did believe that Jesus ascended to heaven, but that wasn't what his resurrection was about. His resurrection was on the third day, and he physically came out of the tomb. So the idea in the Greco-Roman world of ascensions is interesting as a parallel, but it doesn't explain the belief in a resurrection. What we have to ask then is, can we find the origins of this belief of Jesus' resurrection in the Jewish world? Because we know, for example, that Jews believed that there would be a great day of resurrection at the end of time when all the dead would be raised. That was well known, and it's mentioned numerous times in the Gospels themselves, perhaps most famously when Jesus says to Mary and Martha about their brother Lazarus, "Do not grieve, he will rise again," and they say, we know he'll rise again at the great resurrection at the end of time. And Jesus says, no, slightly sooner than that. So clearly, there was this Jewish belief of the great resurrection. Perhaps that's where the idea came from. Except, again, it's the wrong kind of idea. Because the early Christians are not claiming that Jesus will rise again at the end of time, brackets, like everyone else. They're claiming specifically that he had risen again in the middle of history, and that his resurrection was the first fruits of the great resurrection that was to come at the end of time. They're making an extraordinary claim. They're saying that a little bit of the resurrection of the dead at the end of time has already happened. Now, to put it bluntly, this is a little bit like saying the end of the world has come. A bit. That's what they're saying. They're saying an end of the world thing has already happened. The first fruits of the resurrection have already happened. And I can find no parallel for that kind of idea in any pre-Christian Jewish sources. They all talk about the resurrection at the end of time, but the idea that someone might rise from the dead in the middle of history, that is not there. In other words, we cannot easily explain where this idea came from, either from the Greco-Roman world or from the Jewish world in which Jesus lived. The paradox is that the early Christians were claiming that the end of the world had come a little bit. And that puzzling claim is the one that needs to be explained. What would lead the early Christians to think in such a way? Final question. How did the early Christians argue for this belief? We have, from the first century AD and from the centuries either side of it, a good deal of both religious and philosophical propaganda for various people arguing various religious and philosophical points of view. And what strikes me is the different ways they argued. There were some who argued philosophically. The famous Greek philosopher and logician Zeno, the founder of Stoicism, for example, proposed the following logical syllogism, the following little logical argument for your discussion. It is reasonable to honour the gods. Premise number one. Premise number two. It would not be reasonable to honour beings that did not exist. Deduction. Therefore, the gods exist. Now, this is actually what logicians in technical language call dodgy. And the reason it is simple. The premise number one, that it is reasonable to honour the gods, already presumes that there are gods, and then just argues through to the conclusion. It's not actually proof. Well, I hate to say it, but we do this too. We use this kind of logic. We say the Bible is the word of God, and when people ask us how we know, we say, it says so. Again, it's simply a matter that we're presuming the truth of the argument we want to make. It may be true, but it's bad logic. Zeno could argue the case he did because in his culture most people took it as reasonable that the gods existed, and so it didn't really need proving in any really strict sense. It simply needed support. And his argument was sufficient. So there were people who argued for philosophical points of view or religious points of view philosophically. There were also people who argued for religious and philosophical points of view mystically, describing how they had had visionary experiences which showed them things that ordinary people had never seen. And they argued that there were mysteries which had been revealed to them which they could then teach you. And there were people who argued mythically, as in the case of the Osiris material. People who argued simply by telling stories with exemplary value about Osiris dying every winter, being raised every spring. Mythologically, it meant life returns, and that's really, really important and really, really good. When you compare the way that the people in the ancient environment argued with the way Paul argued his case in 1 Corinthians 15, I think the contrast is really striking. Because compared to philosophical arguments, compared to mystical revelations, compared to mythology, what Paul argues is that you should believe that Jesus rose from the dead because he appeared to more than 500 brothers at the one time, and most of them are still alive. Go and ask them. The early Christians argued from eyewitness evidence. And that is striking, because it is not the way most people in their cultural environment argued for religious or philosophical viewpoints. Most people didn't think religion was about recent history. Most people didn't think religion was about historical events at all. Most people thought that religion was to do with the dream time and affected all of human history at some abstract level. But the early Christians said, no, Jesus rose from the dead while Pontius Pilate was governor in Judea, and there are more than 500 eyewitnesses, most of whom are still alive. Check with them if you like. So we have a case. Number one, the earliest evidence for the resurrection of Jesus goes back to approximately before 40 AD. Number two, the evidence that we have in the Gospels that is written down later appears to have been cautiously transmitted without too much theological hindsight. Number three, it is really not obvious where the belief in the resurrection of Jesus could have come from. And number four, the early Christians argued from eyewitness evidence when they could. Now, let me explain what I think this does not prove. I don't think this proves that the resurrection happened. In the end, a hardened skeptic could simply say, look, resurrections don't happen. People who are dead stay dead. It's so obvious it doesn't need proof. Come on! And this does not provide an argument which they can be overthrown with. They can say, I don't care what your explanation is, any explanation is more likely than a resurrection. And that's an argument with which I simply disagree, but I can understand the force of it. I don't think this proves that the resurrection happened. What I think it does show, however, is that if the resurrection did not happen, we really do not understand what did. There is no plausible explanation for the early evidence, for the cautious transmission of the evidence, for the explanation that there is no explanation for the origin of the belief in Jesus' resurrection. There is, in fact, no historically credible explanation that I can find except the one the early Christians gave, which is that it happened. Now, if in the end that is just impossible, feel free to replace it with some other theory. But I'm afraid I have not found a theory that's at all historically credible, other than the one the early Christians gave. In very brief, then, what we seem to have is an argument that suggests that the early Christian claim must at least be taken seriously. And the possibility arises, and it's the slogan for the mission, that you only live twice. But that's because Jesus did. And that's where we'll leave the issue hanging.